Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 13th of July. Our guest this hour has written an absolutely riveting book. He's written another one as well, but this is called Pandora's Seed, The Unforeseen Cost of Civilization. And Spencer Wells says that what the crux of the book is about is when our ancestors created agriculture around 10,000 years ago, they had no idea of what other changes they were setting in motion. And what's going on with us, with our use of resources and the Industrial Revolution and the technological advancements that we've had just in the last 20 years or so in this country, that we may have no idea of what changes we are setting in motion as well. It is filled with fascinating information because, as you know, he's the leading population geneticist and director of the Genographic Project from National Geographic. He started getting interested in the past at a very young age. He is the National Geographic Explorer in Residence, and he is spearheading the Genographic Project, calling it a dream come true. His earlier book, The Journey of Man, also a television program, he began his field studies in 1996 with a survey of Central Asia. In 1998, he expanded study to include some 25,000 miles of Asia and the former Soviet republics. His research findings led to advances in the understanding of the male Y chromosome and its ability to trace ancestral human migration. Well, he's been all over the world, 36 countries since this project began. His wife is a documentary filmmaker, and this is really about as interesting as it gets. Here's our phone number for you to join our conversation. The book is, did I tell you the name of the new book? I don't think I did. Pandora's Seed, The Unforeseen Cost of Civilization. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@WPR.org. Hello, Spencer. Thank you so much for being with us.
Hello, Kathleen. Wow, yeah. What an introduction.
Well, you know, it's just amazing what you've done, I must say. And I was reading the book yesterday. I'm going to read it very carefully now because it's filled with all this information. I figured I could just talk about this forever. And what, aren't you a lucky guy to be doing this for your life?
I am. I'm incredibly lucky. I mean, as you say, I'm a population geneticist by training. That's what I have my PhD in. But I'm really a geneticist and anthropologist. And, you know, as you said, I get to travel the world and meet fascinating people and discover new scientific details and, you know, kind of fill in the gaps in our knowledge of human history. It's amazing.
Yeah, it is amazing. Are you okay? I know you were you had a bike accident a couple weeks ago. Are you feeling okay?
I actually didn't have a bike accident.
Oh, you didn't?
Yeah, I had a car accident about 2 months ago when I was in South Africa making a film.
Ooh.
I broke my nose and had 17 stitches on my forehead and still have a little scar there. But now I'm feeling fine.
Oh, good. I'm glad to hear that. Well, I hardly even know where to start with you, except I think that we ought to go to this huge change that took place. And ask you the question that you ask in the book. We went from hunters-gatherers, we became farmers. What major changes took place genetically and in all kinds of ways because we chose farming? And I guess the other question is, why did we choose it?
Yeah, well, as you say, it's a radical shift. And it doesn't seem like one today because we're so used to living in an agricultural society. But if you think back, you know, over millions and millions of years of evolution, we're living like any other species. We're living as hunters and gatherers, and we're finding our food as we can out in the wild. And then around 10,000 years ago, a few groups of people living around the world in various locations decided to settle down and start growing their food. And that, again, was a radical shift. And the reason for the shift, we believe, and I trace this in the book, is that there was a lot of climatic change going on at this time. So let's go back a little bit earlier. We originated as a species, Homo sapiens, in Africa about 200,000 years ago. And we stick around in Africa for over 100,000 years, and then we start to expand around the planet, really beginning around 60,000 years ago or so. And so that's, you know, fully modern humans, behaviorally modern and so on, using stone tools and all of this. But during this expansion, starting 60,000 years ago, we're in an ice age. Okay, so conditions are really, really tough. And so we're expanding into Asia and into Europe 35,000 years ago or so, and crossing the Bering Land Bridge into the Americas 15 to 20,000 years ago. All of this was going on during an ice age. And so we had basically colonized the planet under these really intense conditions. Now, the ice age, as all ice ages do eventually, ended around 15,000 years ago, and the conditions started to improve. And that allowed human populations to start to expand. And so we started to grow in numbers. And in some places, we started to specialize in the plants that were living in those regions. And so in the Middle East, we're specializing in wheat and barley. In southern China and northeastern India, we're specializing in gathering wild rice. In Mesoamerica, southern Mexico, we're specializing in gathering things related to modern corn. And so the population, again, started to expand. People started to specialize in these grain crops. Now, what happened toward the end of the last ice age is there was a lot of up and down in the climatic conditions. So, you know, conditions improved, and then suddenly they got really bad again. The period known as the Younger Dryas that lasted for about 1,000 years. And when this happened, basically we had exceeded what the ecologists would call the carrying capacity of the land as hunter-gatherers. So there were too many people living there to survive in ice age-like conditions gathering all these grain crops. And so we had to innovate to survive, and that innovation involved planting those very crops that we had been gathering. So we developed agriculture in a period of crisis.
And we were down to, we could have just wiped ourselves out at some point. You talk about the population explosion after we made that switch, but I was amazed that we were down to only 2,000 people before that happened. 2,000!
Well, we were down to about 2,000 if you go back to roughly 70,000 years ago. And so this is, again, when we're all still living in Africa, it's prior to that expansion out of Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And that, again, it was due to a climatic shift, and conditions got really tough. And again, we had to innovate, and we changed our behavior at that time. There may have been genetic changes that led to this. And that's when we become behaviorally modern. So we start to probably speak using modern syntactic language, subject, verb, objects. You can convey complex ideas. The tools become much more finely crafted. So basically, all of these changes, we became smarter in effect, allowed us to make that leap out of Africa and expand around the world.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, by the time we developed agriculture, we were probably up to, you know, 5, maybe at most 10 million people. And after that, of course, we're up to nearly 7 billion today, and increasing to maybe 9.5 billion by the middle of this century.
Hmm. And it wasn't all that long ago that we first started doing all of this in the whole history of things, was it?
Yeah, it's only about 350 human generations. It's really not that far back at all.
Really? 350 human generations?
Yeah.
Wow, amazing. So what happened to, this is where it gets confusing for me, what happens to our genetic structure when we make that change? We're finding that we're susceptible, some populations are, to certain kinds of diseases or intolerances when it comes to food. How do you determine what happened and what did happen?
Yeah, well, I actually start off the book looking at the evidence of selection in the human genome. So the evidence for that Darwinian force, natural selection, which you can see very clearly in the DNA, and there are hundreds of positions where you can pick this up. There is a study that I talk about done by a colleague of mine, Jonathan Pritchard, at University of Chicago. And so he found hundreds of places scattered around the human genome that have been subject to very recent selection. And all of these changes had occurred, the strong selection had occurred in the last 10,000 years. And part of that, a large part of it, we believe, was due to adaptation to this new culture. And so the best example is probably lactase, the lactase gene, which produces the enzyme that allows you to metabolize lactose, the sugar in milk. All babies are born with a functioning copy of this, and they express it, and of course they can digest the milk, which is what they live on for the first 6 months to a couple of years, perhaps, of life. And then later on in life, they lose the ability to do that. So it, you know, kind of the ancestral state, the normal state, if you will, in humans is lactose intolerance. Now, in some populations who domesticated cattle and sheep and goats 5 to 10,000 years ago, they retained the ability to digest that sugar into adulthood. And you can see very strong evidence of selection around that gene in those populations. So Europeans, people living in the Middle East, and some African groups.
And that's true of other kinds of foods as well?
Well, it seems to be, yes. Yeah. So there are genes that are involved in helping you to metabolize things that are in large doses might be poisonous, for instance, so they kind of clear out the junk that occurs in your food, perhaps due to new cooking methods, new things in the diet. But yeah, we see evidence in lots of genes for this very strong selection in the last 10,000 years.
Mm-hmm. And tell me about population, exactly how much it grew, because it just took off. And at what point it may have reached a dangerous level?
Well, you know, we're adapted as a species to live in groups of, you know, a few dozen to perhaps as many as 150 people. That's the estimate that evolutionary psychologists give us. And, of course, when we developed agriculture, we gained the ability to produce as many people as we wanted to, in effect. So you simply plant more crops, you can grow more people. And the population did exactly that. And so, you know, we went from living in these relatively small hunter-gatherer groups to living in villages and ultimately cities of thousands of people, tens of thousands of people. And it's a way of life that we still haven't completely adapted to yet. It's, you know, there's a lot of stimulation involved in living in those societies, and it's good in some ways. But our brains, in a way, aren't really adapted to that yet.
Mm-hmm. And there are all kinds of, we're jumping ahead to the end of the book here, too, as a result of how many people we have, and also because of modern technology that we have to be concerned about. We used to have plagues. Now we have the threat of different kinds of diseases, which we never had to worry about before, because we can carry something if we're traveling to China and we're bringing a certain kind of thing into China, and then all of a sudden we got a disease that has spread all over the world.
Yeah, you look at the spread of swine flu and,
right,
you know, avian flu, all these other things that have come about. Global pandemics are things that really could only exist in the present-day world. You know, they certainly wouldn't have happened 10,000, 15,000 years ago.
Mm-hmm. So is there something that we should have learned that we didn't learn when we made the transition from hunter-gatherers to farmers? And now, what do you call us now? What are we now?
Homo technologicalists or something like that. But yeah, I mean, we're basically homo agriculturalists.
Okay.
So we're, you know, we're agricultural humans. And, yeah, I mean, I suppose the take-home message of the book is that all of these decisions that make sense in the here and now, so it made total sense to develop agriculture 10,000 years ago, carry with them unintended consequences that play out over many, many generations. And, you know, as you mentioned, some of the technologies that I discuss in the book, genetic engineering our children, is something that's starting to happen now, choosing the genes that we put into our kids. You know, we now have the ability to do that. And it is actually happening. You know, by making these decisions, we're setting in motion things that are going to play out for hundreds, thousands of years even. And right. So we have to be very careful about anticipating what those consequences might be.
Right. And tell me how some of our choices have landed us with huge rates of childhood obesity. Diabetes is a huge concern among adults, type 2. How did that happen?
Well, it was really down to a couple of things. The major one was a big shift in diet. So if you look at these hunter-gatherer groups that are living in places like the Middle East, immediately prior to the development of agriculture, they're subsisting on, you know, 150-some-odd different plant species. So there's a huge amount of diversity in the diet. And as soon as they develop agriculture, these early Neolithic people are living on as few as 8 species. Hmm. In fact, they're getting most of their calories from wheat and barley. And so there's a huge increase in the amount of carbohydrates in the diet, which, again, is something that we're not really adapted to. You know, we were adapted to graze on lots of different species and a lot of meat in the diet and so on. And so what you see immediately is people seem to be less healthy. They're dying younger. They're much shorter, which is an effect of decreased nutrition. And they have a huge increase in cavities. Due to the increase in carbohydrates. And so all of these things are signs that we've developed this diet that, yes, it's allowing us to survive, but it's not really good for us. And so you fast forward that through, you know, a couple of hundred generations, couple it with the fact that agriculturalists are sedentary. They have to stay in the same place. You know, you're growing your crops out in a field. You have to gather them and store them. You know, it's ultimately a very sedentary way of life. And then you start to specialize, and eventually you get people who aren't doing any physical work at all. You couple that with a high carbohydrate diet, and basically that's the recipe for childhood obesity and the obesity epidemic that we see today.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's some obvious lessons from that, right?
Well, yeah, I think we should try to certainly increase the diversity of our diets. You know, try to get back to that 150-plus plant species and, you know, to reduce the amount of refined carbohydrates and so on.
Right. Yeah.
and I get some exercise. You know?
Right.
It's pretty simple, as my doctor says to me.
We're going to welcome phone calls for you in a moment. Spencer Wells is our guest this hour. His latest book, and a fascinating one it is Pandora's Seed, The Unforeseen Cost of Civilization. Spencer is explorer in residence at the National Geographic Society, and he's a professor at Cornell University, leading the Genographic Project, which is collecting and analyzing hundreds of thousands of DNA samples from people around the world in order to decipher how our ancestors populated the planet. He's also, I'm sure many of you are familiar with his other work, The Journey of Man and Deep Ancestry. Our number is 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org, and we'll be with you in a moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We start our phone calls for you, Spencer, from Sarah from Zion, Illinois. Hi, Sarah.
Oh, yeah, I just got here. She said I could ask three questions, so let's, anyway.
Okay.
Okay, first of all, a few years ago, I did a report on Aborigines in Australia, and I thought that I read that they developed sort of an isolation, like more than 7,000 years ago. Like, I thought something like 50,000 years ago, but I just wonder what the truth about that is.
Yeah, the Aborigines have been living in Australia for at least 45,000 years, possibly a little bit longer than that. And ultimately, just like everybody else around the world, they trace back to an African origin. But they probably were part of an early coastal migration that left Africa as far ago as 60,000 years ago. And so they were part of this very first wave of modern humans leaving Africa. So ultimately, they do trace back to Africa, but they have been in Australia for a very long time.
Wow. Okay. Okay, now on this continent, I think when Europeans got here, there were the people who lived here. Some did just hunter gathering, and some were doing a mix of agriculture and hunter gathering. So I just wonder how that's different. How do you explain that?
Well, throughout the world, you know, even up to the time of the European conquests or colonizations, whatever you want to call it, there were people still living as hunter gatherers. There are very few of them left today. You know, there are most a couple of million, but there were still people as recently as a few hundred years ago living all over the world as hunter gatherers. And so, you know, in some cases that was an adaptation of the place where they lived. There were even cases of people who had been agriculturalists going back to a hunter gatherer way of
life. Really?
As they moved, or because the climate shifted and it wasn't possible to grow the crops anymore. So you do see that at various locations around the world. And, you know, people were able to coexist in that way of life. But, you know, basically, agriculture won out very quickly. It happened within a few thousand years. You went from, you know, 99.9% of the world's population being hunter-gatherers to less than 1% very rapidly.
Yeah. Okay. Now I'm really curious about how evolution works, because if we could make these adaptations such as, like, to the lactose tolerance in Europe pretty quickly, and yet it's so much harder for us to adapt to other changes like population size and I don't know what else, probably lots of other things too.
Well, yeah, I mean, we are still in the process of adapting. So, you know, there was a report several years ago where, you know, some geneticist said, oh, you know, we're no longer evolving. We did all of our evolving 50,000 years ago. No, that's not the case. You know, we're still very much in the process of adapting to this new society and the new world we've created. And, you know, it is possible that, you know, if we fast forward another, you know, 2,000-3,000 years and we don't do anything about our genes by choosing the genes that we want in our children, maybe some of the things that afflict us today will be gone. But it's not going to be very pretty. A lot of people are going to die in the process. You know, childhood type 2 diabetes is a good example. It used to be called adult onset, but now there are, you know, kids 9, 10, 11 years old showing up with it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's a sign that there is something about the way we're living that's not quite right for our physiology.
There sure is a sign. It's a pretty dramatic sign, isn't it?
It is, yeah. I mean, you look at obesity rates over the last century, and they've gone up 10 times. And the genes certainly haven't changed that much. I mean, there are genetic details involved in whether you're going to develop obesity or not. But basically, it's down to your lifestyle.
Right. Thank you very much, Sarah, for the call. Mike in Milwaukee, hi.
Hi. Is it possible that this crisis that the world is going through right now has nothing to do with economics? It has to do with a paradigm shift. like from farming to industrialization. Now, maybe the industrial age has just ended. And that brings up another issue, is that many people are looking for jobs, J-O-B-S. And maybe that era of jobs is over.
Well, that's a good question. I mean, it kind of goes beyond the scope of what I talk about in the book. But certainly, you know, take what's going on in the Gulf of Mexico right now. You know, the reason that oil is flowing out of the ground is because we all need it. Okay, and we have to try harder and harder to get it these days because we've used up all the easy stuff or most of it. We're past the era of what people call peak oil, when it was really easy. You just pump a hole, you know, pump stuff out of a hole in the ground. Now you have to go down really deep, and you have to drill down, you know, far beyond that to actually get to these reserves. And you know, it's a sign that basically that era is probably coming to an end. And you're right. I mean, I think this era we're living through right now is very much a crisis point. And I think the economic situation is, you know, again, it's beyond the scope of what I talk about, but I think some of these jobs that are gone now are probably not going to come back. And I think it's a shift in what people do and how we live our lives and the sorts of skills that people need. And it's going to be a rather radical shift.
Can you tell me, you mentioned this earlier and I meant to follow up on it, what kinds of, I don't even know what word to use to describe this, putting genes into people to make sure they don't get disease or to change their genetic structure if they're predisposed to a certain disease. You said some of that is going on with that right now. What is that, Spencer?
Well, the easiest way at the moment, I mean, it is possible to use a virus to introduce genes into somebody who is alive, but the easiest way at the moment is something called pre-implantation genetic diagnosis. And so if you go in for IVF, in vitro fertilization, where they mix together the sperm and the egg and they let the cells develop and divide and so on, you know, you can actually take a cell out at the point where there are 8 cells. So the morning of day 3 after the IVF procedure is performed, you've got 8 cells in the developing embryo. You can take one cell out and the other 7 develop perfectly normally into a child. And you can test the DNA in that one cell, and it contains the complete genome. And so you create a panel of these embryos, you know, 10, 20 of them. You test the genes, and you basically choose the ones to implant in the womb. So you're choosing the genes for your children, but you're also choosing the genes for your grandchildren, great-grandchildren, and so on, every child in the future.
Goodness.
So that it's a big responsibility.
We're doing that right now?
Yeah. Yeah, it is happening. And I talk about Charlie Whitaker in the book, who his parents did that because he had a medical condition, a genetic disorder known as diamond black fin anemia. And they basically wanted to create a child. They were planning to have more children anyway, but they wanted to make sure that the child they had would be able to serve as a donor, a bone marrow donor, for their son to cure the disease. And so they basically chose the right genes to implant.
Goodness.
And there's a clinic in California now that will actually test all sorts of genes for you. So whether your child is going to have blonde hair or blue eyes or genes that predispose to higher IQ. I mean, as we discover these genetic variants that predispose to these various conditions or traits, we're going to be able to choose the genes to put in our children.
Hmm. Thanks, Mike, for your call. Peter in Oshkosh. Hi.
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 My question to you is this. We're seeing in the current economic situation a lot of people, including myself, having to leave houses and move into RVs, move more into things like living on boats and therefore traveling a lot more and becoming more nomadic in nature. Is this going to be a way that we will be able to have populations that will have a much larger diversity of food input because they're traveling to other countries and eating other foods?
That's certainly possible. I mean, one of the wonderful things about travel is that you get to try new foods, things that you know, might not have thought of eating at home. So, you know, that's certainly a possibility, yeah.
Maybe this is a part of a solution.
Maybe it is. It depends on how mobile we are and, you know, what we use to power that mobility. But, yeah, I think it might be.
Okay. Thanks very much.
Thank you, okay, Peter, bye. For your call. Let's talk about people and animals for a moment. We've had lots of E. coli problems and various issues concerning food and the proximity of the food that we grow to the animals that we eat. Is there a lesson to be learned that maybe that's not a good idea?
Well, I think, you know, factory farming in general, it's something that obviously provides us with inexpensive meat, which is what you're really talking about. But if you visit one of these places, a feedlot, you know, where they have a million head of cattle out there, they're not very pretty places, and they are actually pretty dirty. There's a lot of waste that's generated by farming animals in that way. And I think most people, if they had a choice, wouldn't choose to eat animals that had been raised in that sort of a scenario if you actually visited one. On the other hand, it provides us, as I said, with very inexpensive food. And so we want that. And because most of us never actually see how this food is produced, we really don't care that much. You know, we don't have to think about it until we get one of these outbreaks of, as you say, E. coli, one of the bad E. coli strains that shows up, and then kids start dying. You know, school lunches are infected with it, whatever it might be, and then people are up in arms. But in fact, you know, the whole process is not very nice to witness. And so, you know, it would be better, I think, to return to a scenario where things are raised a little bit closer to organic methods. Maybe organic is asking too much, but, you know, in conditions where the animals are perhaps a little bit happier and healthier.
Mm-hmm. Carol is next. Hi, Carol.
Hi. I had my father's DNA tested, and he was identified as a member of the Eve haplogroup. And it helped me, who I've always had a rash when I eat products that have wheat, but tests don't identify officially that I'm celiac. And when I found out my father's DNA indicated Eve haplogroup and he was located, or his origins were located in Ethiopia, I decided that eating rice might not be such a bad idea. I just was curious also with that comment. We have some African-American family members, and I was wondering if there's any particular group that tests for origins of the African-Americans that you would say would be most accurate.
Yeah, well, you know, the issue is that because we originated in Africa and we lived there for longer than we've lived anywhere else, you know, basically two-thirds of our history as a species, nearly three-quarters, there's a lot more diversity in Africa, and we're just beginning to understand that diversity. And that's, you know, part of the reason we launched the Genographic Project, is to understand these patterns of diversity around the world in indigenous communities. And so, you know, at the moment, we don't know enough about African diversity to be able to, you know, place somebody in a tribe of origin, although there are companies out there that will attempt to do that. The issue is that we don't have a big enough database yet. And so we're trying to develop that. And so the genographic test, you know, those test results, the basic genetic data is never going to change, but the interpretation will get better and better as time goes on and we collect more data. So, you know, all I can say is keep checking back and see what we find out.
It's interesting to read your chapters, and you've done this work in the past, too, that look at our common origin in Africa and how our skin changed to get more vitamin D, et cetera. You know, you read all of this and think, well, this should once and for all do away with any kind of racism in the whole world, right? It doesn't do that, but it is.
It would be nice, but yeah, unfortunately.
But it should, right?
It doesn't work that way. Yeah, it really should. You know, because you look underneath the surface, all these superficial features that distinguish us, and we're nearly identical
right. At
the genetic level, 99.9% identical. And so, you know, if that person over there who seems to be so different, speaks a different language, has a different skin color, is basically your cousin.
Right. We all came from... At what point did we all come from the same people? How many years ago?
Well, the most recent common ancestor of everybody alive today was a man. This is tracing the Y chromosome, who lived in Africa around 60,000 years ago. And so everybody alive today is descended from that man.
Isn't that something? And it's only 60,000 years ago.
Yeah, 2,000 human generations.
Oh, my gosh. We're going to see everybody differently today. We're all cousins. Hey, Chrissy, my cousin. Yeah, so great. All right. Thanks, Carol, very much for your call. Let's go to Jim in Waukesha. Hi, Jim.
Yes, the most excellent show. Thank you. My first question is, I had heard, I think, probably on public radio, an anthropologist saying something about stable population in Mesoamerica until they discovered adding or milling maize with soda ash or something like that. And then after doing that, the maize becomes a much more complete food, and the population climbed. Have you know anything of that?
Yeah, I have heard about that, and he's absolutely right. The initial population expansion was, of course, when they developed maize agriculture, but then they improved the methods for extracting the nutrients from it using the lime that they added. And so, yeah, there is evidence for a population expansion around that time.
Do you know the date?
Off the top of my head, no.
Okay.
I'm not a specialist in Mesoamerican archaeology, but I can certainly find out for you.
Okay. Well, that would be great. And then, have you read the book Ishmael?
No, I haven't.
It is an excellent book. I suggest you pick it up and read it. It's about an intelligent ape, a gorilla that takes on a student and gives him a slightly different view of evolution and basically the things you're saying, the hunter-gatherer versus agriculture and how that had changed life on Earth so much and our role as humans in that process.
Yeah. Well,
thanks, Jim, for your call. We go to another Jim, Pleasant Prairie. Hi.
Yes, good morning. A fascinating show, once again. My question is largely cultural. How we have roughly 65% of the American adult population overweight, which I consider a direct parallel to Rome of approximately 2,000 years ago, but also how we have, last few decades, turned history on its head, so to speak, because it used to be the wealthier you were, the more power you had, the more likely you were to be a large, heavy person. But today, it is the lower income people that are more likely to be overweight. And I talk about that
in the book. In fact, I have a chart that shows that. Looking at the U.S. states, the per capita family income. Basically versus obesity rates, and you see this amazing kind of negative correlation. So the wealthier people tend to have the time to go out and exercise, I suppose, but also, of course, access to healthier food.
Mm-hmm. You look at Samoa, where there have been dramatic changes in the weight of the population.
Yeah, there have. I mean, you can look at American Samoa versus Western Samoa, and in American Samoa, they live a much more American lifestyle, as you might expect. And the obesity rates are about 2 to 3 times higher than they are in Western Samoa, where they live a much more traditional lifestyle. And so, you know, more than half the population is clinically obese, and they have a very high rate of diabetes. I think it's somewhere around 25-30% in adults. And, it's down to the lifestyle. Again, it's the sedentary lifestyle coupled with the highly processed food.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Jim. Mary in Wauwatosa. Hi.
Hi, Kathleen. It's so nice to know you're my cousin. You've been my idol.
Hey, Cousin Mary.
And, Professor, I'm also a Cornell grad way back.
Fantastic.
72,
go
so
big red.
Long before you. But at any rate, my observation is on Agent Orange is one of those items that the VA has made for coverage because of the high amount of type 2 development in veterans from over there. Australia's is the same, though they have more chemical agents that they listed. And I'm I was a registered dietitian working till I hit a combat training accident of a chemical explosion. But at any rate, my observation is that not only are these vet of type 2, their kids have type 2. And since it's a familial disease, it can keep rolling and rolling for God knows how long, generations. And then I'm looking at the fact, kind of like they're doing in Vietnam, with all of the neurological damage, because like 2 of my 4 kids have abnormal heart formations. One has neural fibromatosis, and one has got so colorblind they can't believe it. But I just thought your observation on the diabetes and for what I saw. And when I worked at Children's, I saw type 2 coming in 2-, 3-, and 4-year-olds. So,
oh, my gosh.
Really? Wow.
Yeah. So, and this was a while ago, and we kind of flew by the seat of our pants because there was nothing written. Now they've got things coming along. So I don't know what you have seen, and I've been kind of, because of the accident, I've been out of the picture since 2003. Mm. But I do read some of the things online. So I just thought I'd share that one because
that's interesting. I wasn't aware of the correlation with Agent Orange exposure. That's wow, kind of surprising. Well, what is interesting is that you mentioned it seems to go, you know, spread down through the generations, kind of inherited in a way. You know, that could be because of the way the kids are being raised. But there is evidence now, there's more and more evidence for what's known as epigenetic inheritance. So methylation patterns in the DNA would be the best example. Exposure to certain environments will actually create changes in the way the genes are expressed, and that can be passed on through the generations. So it's, you know, it's a fascinating time in genetics, and that may very well play a role.
Hmm. Thank you, Mary, so much for the call. Our guest this hour is the author of Pandora's Seed, is his latest book, The Unforeseen Cost of Civilization. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Spencer Wells, explorer in residence at the National Geographic Society and professor at Cornell University. He leads the Genographic Project, which is collecting and analyzing hundreds of thousands of DNA samples from people all over the world in order to decipher how our ancestors populated the planet. He is the author of two other books, The Journey of Man and Deep Ancestry. And we'll take more phone calls in a moment. A couple lines are, oh no, they're not, but they will be. 800-486-8655 is the number, the email address, talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go back to phone calls for Spencer Wells, author of Pandora's Seed, The Unforeseen Cost of Civilization, and Mary in Wauwatosa. Mary? No, we've been there already. Let's go to Joe from Madison. Hi, Joe.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
For the great conversation that you guys are having. I appreciate it. My question is about genetic engineering, and I'll use personal examples. My mom has Alzheimer's, and so that's on my mom's side. And then on my dad's side, his grandma has Alzheimer's. So I kind of feel like I'm at the crossroads of that, my brother and I. And my wife has multiple sclerosis. And one of the things that we've talked about with having kids is, you know, since we both kind of feel like we've got this, you know, bug in the rug that, you know, it might be something that we pass on to our kids. And is that something that we would be able to test for, and if so, is that something that we might be able to, you know, correct, for lack of better words?
We know very little about what causes MS. There have been some genetic correlations found, but they're not very strong, any individual genetic factor. So at this point, I would say no. For Alzheimer's, we know a little bit more. There's a genetic variant known as APOE4 that tends to be a much higher frequency in people with early onset Alzheimer's. And you can certainly test for that. So that one you might be able to do something about, but the MS at this point in time, probably not.
So what are the resources? You know, obviously we don't have to go into all the details, but what are some resources that you might be able to direct me to that I could check for the Alzheimer's?
Well, you would basically have to do this through an IVF clinic, and you would have to explain to the people at the clinic that you have this family history of these traits, and that they need to be testing for some of the known genetic variants. So you would basically create that panel of embryos using IVF techniques, and then you would test one cell from each at the blastocyst stage. And, you know, you would choose the ones that don't have the genetic variants that are known to contribute to those disorders.
That's awesome. That's cool. Well, great. Well, I really appreciate the information for all the knowledge that you're helping people understand right now. Thanks a lot.
Sure.
For the show.
Thank you.
Thanks, Joe. Tell us, I'm always interested in why people do what they do, but this interest of yours in things ancient and how we got here and how we developed is really a lifelong thing with you, isn't it, Spencer?
It is. In fact, you know, when I was a kid, I wanted to be a historian. First thing that really piqued my interest and my curiosity. And what led to that, I mean, I was generally interested in all sorts of things, but I went to see the King Tut exhibit, the one that toured back
in the
70s. And I saw it in New Orleans, and I was about 8 years old, and it absolutely blew me away, and I was convinced I was going to be an archaeologist or a historian of some sort. and got interested in science secondarily when my mother went back to school to get her PhD in biology later. And I got to hang out in the lab with her and discover that science is really fun, and it's about solving puzzles and using high-tech equipment and all that cool stuff that little boys like, and ended up wanting to combine the two. So using high-tech science as a tool to study the past.
It's wonderful. Patrick in Wisconsin Rapids. Hi.
Hi. Honestly, I can't wait to check out that book. And I'm a big Richard Dawkins fan. I just read The Greatest Show on Earth here a couple of months ago.
Yep.
And as far as archaeology goes, you just talked about that. I know it's off subject, but I always felt Native Americans were so populated here that 5,000 to 6,000 years ago, and I just got to make this quick, that if we'd have landed, evident, obviously we couldn't, but if we'd have landed with a parachute, we would have been seen in this area of the state or any area of the state. I thought it was just that many Indians. But anyway, yeah, I can't wait to check out the book, Pandora's Seed. I agree with you. I think a lot of physiological problems today we have are directly correlated to how we live, and basically, to me, what it stems from, a lot of it is an industrialized world, and I have to agree with you on that. But anyway, I guess that's about all I got to say. Thank you.
Thank you, Patrick.
Okay, thanks. Yeah, I mean, listen, I don't want to sound like a doom and gloom prophet. That's not what the book is about at all. It's really just trying to get people to kind of take a step back and look at the society we've created and ask about, you know, what are some of these unintended consequences of things we're doing today? You know, how might they play out 1,000 years down the line? And we're not used to thinking in those ways. And so I use the example of agriculture. I'm not advocating us returning to being hunter-gatherers. There's no way we could. You know, there are too many people on the planet.
Right.
But I think we need to start asking ourselves, well, how can we incorporate some of these ways of living that our hunter-gatherer ancestors had and the existing hunter-gatherers have today into our present-day lifestyles and start to live perhaps in more harmony with both our physiology and with the world around us?
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Patrick, for the call. We go to Al next in Minnesota. Hi, Al.
Hello. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
One thing that you might want to look at, there's a movie out, there's a documentary called Food Incorporated.
Yep.
And
very good.
I don't know if you're familiar with it, but it might give you a completely different look at it. What it basically says is McDonald's is the biggest user of beef, and them and some of the major seed companies have That's one of the reasons that the poor people are heavier, is that it's cheaper. You can't make what you can buy at McDonald's, and it's heavy and all kinds of things, and it's not necessarily good physically. So anyway, you might want to take a look at that. But my
No, absolutely. It's a very good film. Eric Schlosser's book, Fast Food Nation, Michael Pollan's book, Omnivore's Dilemma.
Yes.
I mean, there are a lot of people writing about these sorts of things and in the way we produce food today. And there are a lot of problems. And, you know, as you point out, a lot of things are added to some of these foods. So you've got, you know, sugar being added to everything these days, or high fructose corn syrup, to be more exact. And, you know, that's not a good thing. People who eat that stuff love the taste, but they eat too much of it and they get too many calories.
Mm-hmm.
So that's
right.
For the reason for the epidemic, you're absolutely right.
Oh, maybe they're poor, but they're certainly not missing any meals, and that's not necessarily a very correct analysis of that. What from a DNA standpoint, I've tried to find out about my DNA, and I've sent in my DNA and so on, and paid my $200, but I have not had any positive results in regards to telling me much. It was more of a sales thing, a gimmick than anything else. Do you have anything that you would suggest, a system or an analysis that might be a little bit more comprehensive and a little more on the up and up, so to speak?
Well, I'm not sure where you had your DNA tested. I mean, I run the Genographic Project, as you heard at the top of the hour. And so, you know, we offer direct-to-consumer genetic tests to tell you about your ancestry, but it's deep ancestry. It tells you about, you know, where your indigenous ancestors would have come from hundreds of years ago. If you're interested in genealogy, there are good companies out there that offer you, you know, the opportunity to not only get your DNA tested and find out about these ancient things, but also, you know, find long-lost cousins, perhaps, matches in their database. Family tree DNA is a good example of that. But, you know, you could certainly start with Genographic if you want. It's by far and away the cheapest way of doing it, and you're contributing to the nonprofit work we're doing around the world scientifically.
Hmm. And yet we've already learned that we're all cousins, so...
Exactly.
We're all long-lost cousins.
Exactly.
Yeah. Thanks, Hale, so much for your call. We go to Laura from Green Bay. Hi, Laura.
Hi, and thanks for taking my call. The first thing I wanted to mention is those Ishmael books. That's actually a trilogy, and it's partly why I bought the book and your book on Pandora's Seed, and I just finished that yesterday.
Oh.
I thought it was saying a lot of things that needed to be said about genetic engineering and the kind of people we are on this planet that is going for, like, immediate gratification. But what I don't get from any of the Ishmael books, and one is my Ishmael. I can't remember the one in between, and I forgot the author, too, because I got them out of the library and took them back. But what should we be doing, you know, to be more like hunter-gatherers? I didn't quite understand, I'm afraid.
Well, you know, it's really a question of living the lifestyle that we've been told about for the last couple of decades. You know, eat more diversity, eat more diverse plants in your diet. Try to eat grass-fed beef, for instance, rather than grain-fed. That seems to be healthier. And get some exercise, you know. So, you know, it's really not that complicated. It's living like our parents or grandparents might have lived, you know, and relying less on these factory-produced meals.
Well, I can certainly handle that.
Well, good, Laura. Thank you. Thanks very much for your call. We go to Beth next in Richland Center. Hi, Beth.
Well, good morning, cousins.
Hi, cousins. How are you?
Wonderful discussion. I'm going to refer to your guest, Spencer, by your first name. I apologize because
That's
I didn't
fine.
Catch your last name. I don't wish to presume. However, I heard the term epigenetics, and my ears perked up because I have begun studying the work of Dr. Bruce Lipton, if you're
mm-hmm.
familiar with that name, and a cell biologist.
Yeah.
Okay. The author of The Biology of Belief, a book I highly recommend to one and all. And the take on epigenetics, as you know, that he highlights is that genes control our bodies, direct our bodies, but astoundingly, our beliefs direct our genes. And this is discernible not through some fantasy or spirituality, or not that I'm equating the two, or in that route, but rather frank, right on the lab table, cell biology regarding how information is received via the cell membranes.
Yeah, I mean, certainly our behaviors determine things like hormone levels and the types of hormones that are circulating, and that can have an effect on the way genes are expressed, and that may have an epigenetic effect that could be passed on. Yeah, it's entirely possible.
Thank you.
I
just hope that I would love to see a panel sometime with yourself and Dr. Lipton and maybe three or four or five other people of your caliber and really hear this, all of this brought together. It would be absolutely fantastic. I hope you can do that sometime.
Yeah, that
would
be interesting.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Beth, very much. We have time for one more call. Clay in Mequon. Hi.
Hello. Quick question. Knowing that there are many others who have looked at this from various perspectives, including authors like Tom Hartman and Bill McKibben and William McDonough and even Thomas Friedman, they've all labeled where they believe we're going as a civilization, as individuals. I wonder if you have done the same. If you can attribute a name, I guess, to our next path, our next era.
Well, I think we're living through an era of crisis, and we touched on this before. It's not just the economic scenario that's playing out right now, but all of these issues like global warming, which we are, you know, almost certainly contributing to. Even if you don't believe humans are contributing, you can't deny the fact that things are getting warmer, and it's going to cause a massive social upheaval in the next half century. And so, you know, I think all of these issues are coming to a head at this point, and I think in part it's because the population has reached its kind of carrying capacity as, you know, homo agriculturists, and we're going to have to kind of get beyond that phase and move on to the next one where we start to behave more wisely, where we stop being children and adolescents, if you will, and become adults, start thinking about the longer-term consequences of what we do. And so, you know, I see this as a tremendously interesting time to be alive, but certainly not an easy one. You know, I think the last half century has been relatively easy. The people who came of age after the Second World War and grew up during this period of relative affluence where, you know, you could drive gas-guzzling cars and throw beer cans out the window as you went down the highway and all of that, that's just not going to be around anymore. And I think it's going to shift a lot of things in the way we live. You know, the whole notion of retirement, I think, is in the process of changing right now. The idea that you can work until your early 60s and then live happily on your savings, you know, for another 30 or 40 years, I think that's going to go by the wayside as well. You know, so there are a lot of changes coming down the pike right now.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for being with us and for writing yet another extraordinary book. It was great to have you on the air.
It was great to be here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Spencer Wells, the book is Pandora's Seed, The Unforeseen Cost of Civilization. He's explorer in residence at the National Geographic Society and professor at Cornell University. And we thank Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour and Chrissy Pease for on-air production. Until tomorrow, thanks for listening.